Keeping your IT team sharp isn't optional. It's essential. CBT Nuggets delivers high-quality IT training led by real-world experts who know what teams actually need on systems teams will actually use. Whether it's staying current on cloud, networking, or security, CBT Nuggets makes training simple, effective, and scalable. No fluff, no wasted time, just smarter, faster IT teams. Thousands of companies trust CBT Nuggets, and yours can too. Go to cbtnuggets.com/solutions and start training today.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This week on Lunchbox Envy.
In Spain, it's the slang term for money.
Pavarotti used to keep some stashed in the theatre wings to snack on between scenes.
And it's my favourite food of them all. It's pasta! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a food writer and chef, and I'm here with QI Elf Jack.
Hi Rosie, and also hello to my fellow elf Manu.
Hey Jack. Okay, so Rosie, this is your week. This is your area of expertise, pasta.
I don't even know if expertise is the right word. Like fanatic is maybe closer to accurate. Like I love pasta. My first job after culinary school was in an Italian restaurant in London called Cafe Murano, one of Angela Hartnett's restaurants. While I was there, I learned how to make pasta from Italians and also listening to Italians love on their pasta. I would spend most summers in Italy working for a company that hosted luxury culinary holidays in the Veneto, so northeast Italy. Oh, and I just got married there.
Whoa.
And I had a giant lasagna instead of a wedding cake. Woohoo! Oh,
nice.
It was heaven.
Which befits your social media handle, which I believe is
Rosie McKean Pasta Queen.
There we are.
Yeah.
Can we talk about like where pasta is from?
Oh, yes.
Because I looked into this and I am still not 100% sure. And I know it's really hard to pin down the origins of food and dishes in general. From my understanding, it is actually an Italian food because there was a story about Marco Polo bringing it back from China.
Oh, yeah, bust that mess. I mean, Italy didn't exist at the time, but what is now Italy was exporting pasta from before Marco Polo left in the 1200s, was it? Mm-hmm. So I think the Etruscans, so they're talking pre-Romans here, they had a thing called lagana, which were flat sheets of wheat dough, but they were fried. And so I think, I mean, I do think that probably every civilization in Eurasia, at least, had a form of wheat dough, and the Chinese were making dumplings way before this,
and noodles.
Yeah. So you can see why the Marco Polo myth would come about. But what we do know is that in the 9th century, the Arab invaders of Sicily were writing about itiria, which were long strands of semolina dried before cooking, which sounds quite a lot like spaghetti. So I think sometime between the Etruscans, like 1000 years BC, let's say, and these 9th century Arabs, it's a spectrum of like, what can we do with this, with this wheat dough, and how can we make it like pasta? But I do, what I did read is that the Arabs would bring it along the Silk Road as a non-perishable snack, and they didn't add any sauce or cook it. So
wait,
they just snap it off.
Raw. Yeah. It's going to say raw dog in it. And I was like, that's not the right.
Into our first lunchbox, we're going to start with me. And I really struggled with what to bring in because I was like, God, the weight of the world is on my shoulders. The so-called pasta queen is supposed to be bringing in pasta for the pasta podcast. In the end, I landed on just my favourite pasta dish.
Okay.
And my favourite pasta shape.
Fantastic.
So in my lunchbox today, I have got linguine, aglio, olio and anchovy.
Oh.
So basically,
it's still steaming. It's still warm.
Yeah, I just made it before I left. Whoa. I left all the washing up for my husband. So aglio, olio and peperoncino is a very famous pasta dish, which is basically oil, garlic and chili, made with a long extruded dry pasta, which I will explain in a second. I like to make the exact same thing, but with loads of anchovies in, because anchovies are just heaven.
Yeah.
And so it's that with some parsley. And I've also put some Parmesan on it, which is sacrilege
to
some.
I was gonna say,
but I like anchovies and Parmesan together, so I was like, nah.
Can we talk about what pasta is?
Oh, yeah.
So it's made from durum wheat, which you grind up.
Wheat from Durham.
Wheat from Durham.
So it's spelled Durham.
Durham wishes.
Oh, I've this little pasta dish. I'm going to call it pasta.
I'm going to deep fry it.
It's really good.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was actually. Yeah.
Durum wheat means hard, right?
Yeah, it's like a crazy hard kind of wheat. Because you get soft wheats, when you break them down, they turn into like really poofy flour. So the kind of stuff you use in cakes.
Okay.
Whereas when you break this one down, it's really hard. It kind of looks like glass, which is why it makes a much coarser grain, more like maize.
Mm. Okay.
To make semolina, which is the pasta flour, you grind up the durum wheat, and it's actually the endosperm of the wheat that you're grinding, which is a part of the seed that feeds the embryo as it's growing. The endosperm in durum wheat is yellow, which Ooh. Is why pasta is yellow, even if you don't put egg yolk in it.
I think one of the biggest pitfalls with pasta, with people who think that all pasta has egg in it, which it doesn't, yeah. because of what you said, like it's characteristically yellow because of the type of flour that's used. Unless it literally says all'uovo or with egg, it's not got any egg in it. It's vegan. It's literally
it's
flour
wheat and water.
Yeah.
So I did have one question, because I'm never sure what to do when I'm cooking it, in terms of the salt level.
Oh, yeah.
Because apparently you're supposed to salt your pasta water before you cook it. But how much and why?
Well, the way I approach it, the way I was taught to approach it, is with any kind of boiling, not just pasta, when you cook something in water, the way it cooks is through osmosing inside. But I don't think that's the correct use of the word
osmosis.
But like it's osmosis. Yeah. So the hot water goes in and it converts protein, starches, fats into a cooked version of that. When that water goes in, if it is seasoned, it also seasons the inside of whatever you're cooking. So as a good rule of thumb, when you are boiling anything, you should be seasoning that water. Yeah. If you mm-hmm. want it to have any kind of enhanced flavor. Mm-hmm. But the crucial difference with pasta water is more often than not, you are using the water that has cooked the pasta to also lengthen your sauce. So the delicate balance you have to strike is not over seasoning your pasta water so that when it goes into your seasoned sauce, it doesn't end up being really, really, really salty, but also making sure that your water is seasoned enough so that the pasta itself has interior flavor. Okay. So my approach now is that I season my pasta water like I would soup. So if I'm making a broth or a soup, tasting it as I go, I want my pasta water to be roughly as salty as that, but no more. And it used to be, I think for a long time, everyone was like, as salty as the sea. Mm, but actually that's ill-advised. Don't do that.
I looked into this and the sea is so much saltier.
Like, right?
You'd throw up if you
put exactly. that much salt in. So pasta comes in many different shapes and sizes. Mm, in fact,
famously,
it comes in a ton of wild shapes that we'd all love very much.
Has anyone worked out how many exactly, or is it not? Is it one of those uncountable
things? I think it's sort of uncountable because it's constantly evolving. Like, they are inventing new pasta shapes every day.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, there are, between 300 and 600. The other problem is that because of the regionality of Italian cooking, you could say this pasta shape is called this name in this town, and then the town in the mountaintop next door will say it's called something else.
Yeah. Mm.
So are there lots of shapes, or are there lots of different names? Ooh, that's also hard to quantify.
Also, when I'm making tagliatelle, if I make it slightly wobbly, then I've made a new shape, right? But it's not replicable, is it? Yeah.
Well, you call that, actually, there is a name for that. It's called mal tagliati, which means badly cut.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
That's my favorite.
Unlucky,
now.
Mate.
So, is there any practicality in the different plethora of pasta shapes? Do you think some of them retain heat better than others, or scoop up sauce better? I always remember having the peas inside the penne and feeling like a lucky little boy when I found one of those.
There are shapes that, in theory, work best with different types of sauces because they hold them better. When you buy supermarket penne or rigatoni, you might notice that there are ridges on the surface of the pasta, and the ridges are designed to hold the sauce. And the ridges are actually there because they're replicating what fresh, handmade pasta should have, which is lots and lots and lots of tiny ridges from rolling your pasta on wood, using a wooden mattarello, which is the big rolling pin. Mm. And those ridges, those tiny, tiny, tiny little folds in the dough are what holds onto the sauce and, again, ultimately flavors the pasta, right? There are definitely some shapes that hold heat better. The smaller the surface area, the better the heat holding. And also if they have some kind of hole, like a penne or a rigatoni, or like conchiglie, which are the shells. So yeah, it's not conchigli, everyone. By the way, you've been saying it wrong. It's conchiglie. So I often really burn my mouth when I'm cooking them because I'm checking that they're not done. And then there's like literally a gallon of boiling hot water inside it. It just squirts into the back of your mouth and you're like, oh God, I'm blistered. Anyway, they hold heat really well because they hold inside themselves.
Mm. And also, orzo's got, per orzo, it's not much surface area. And it's just usually in a risotto dish. Mm.
Yeah, or a soup.
So orzo is the really, really tiny one that looks like rice.
Yeah. Often called risani or semi di melone, which means melon seeds.
Oh, very nice.
And yeah, they're just, you know, there are lots of people who are like, oh, you shouldn't eat that pasta with that sauce because.
Oh yeah, this is a hot take.
Yeah, thicker sauces, ragus, really creamy ones work better with pastas with bigger surface areas in theory. I think there are some sauces that should be eaten with smaller pastas, or, you know, I basically think no one should be eating fusilli or farfalle. They're just, well, I love the idea of farfalle. Farfalle means bow, by the way, but also means butterfly. Yeah. And actually, farfallina in Italian is slang for a woman's private parts.
Huh.
there are loads of those, though, because I heard that mussels are cozze. Cozze is a...
Yeah,
cozze. Oh, they have figa as well.
Figa, yeah. La figa.
It's a lot of food.
Any Italians are listening, they're going to be like, what are these guys talking about?
This will be a running theme when we do the mussels episode.
It's all food in Italy.
Yeah, that's true. Mm.
And also potato, la patata, in Spanish as well.
Oh, stop it.
La patatina.
Stop it with the potato. Like, the oyster I get... The bow pasta, sorry, not pasta, the butterfly. I'm like, okay.
And even penis is
penne.
It's
without the
want to like bounce on the end. You want to just do penne. But penne is the pasta, but penne is the penis.
Yeah, we want.
I love it. I read that in this country and America and Australia, we are making spaghetti bolognese completely wrong. Apparently, we're using the wrong pasta.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
So Bologna, home of bolognese, is also the home of very good fresh pasta, fresh egg pasta, the most famous of which is tagliatelle. So, long, thin, yellow egg strips, but not as thin as spaghetti or linguine.
Yeah, they're flat, aren't they?
They're flat. Importantly, they're flat because basically the idea is that when you take one, that flat surface catches more of that, you know, minced meat sauce and holds it. Whereas if you try and do that with one strand of spaghetti, it's all just going to fall off because it's round and it's just like on a slip and slide.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the lines in the UK, in America and in Australia, we just were like, we only really wanted to eat spaghetti for a few years. As I understand it, when Italian food and pasta really hit the sort of culinary sphere in the 80s, spaghetti was the only pasta people would eat.
It was readily available.
Yeah. But bolognese really appealed because it was basically like cottage pie interior. So they combined the two. But yes, technically it's the wrong pasta for it. Yeah. Obviously, I think there's a discussion to be had about what is now very British. Like spag bol is a British dish. Like it will come up regularly in those top 10 British dishes. And lasagna as well, there's a very British version of it. I recently had to make... British bolognese for Italians to show them what the flavor profile of a British bolognese would be like versus a traditional bolognese.
What were the main differences? Did you put Worcestershire sauce in?
I put Worcestershire sauce in. I used loads more veg because the Italian version is very meat heavy, meat led. And we use mushrooms, for example, which we never find in Bologna in a bolognese. And lots more chunky celery and carrot and onion and stuff. And as I've heard of people adding ketchup that I would never, but you know, stuff like that. And kind of basically just cooking it less. Like I think for whatever reason,
It's a quick dish.
Spag bol is quite a convenience dish here, whereas over there it's tagliatelle alla bolognese is very much not. It's a long, slow,
decadent process.
Yeah.
So in Bologna, there's a very famous landmark called the Asinelli Tower, and it's a medieval tower that's still standing. Bologna used to be the city of towers that have nearly all fallen down. Anyway, this one's still standing, but it does lean a little bit like the famous one in Pisa. Anyway, it's also the home of tagliatelle, and apparently they have a golden tagliatella inside the mayor's office or the town hall or somewhere, which is the yardstick by which you should measure your tagliatelle against. And it is exactly 1/12,270th the length of the Asinelli Tower.
Crazy. That is a classic Bolognese move, if I've ever heard one. One of the rules that I've always remembered that I read once is that a traditional lasagna alla Bolognese from Bologna should have no more, no less than between 5 and 7 layers. Because 7 and 5 are like lucky numbers.
Oh, nice.
But basically, like, you shouldn't have less than that, otherwise it's not really a good lasagna. Yeah. And you shouldn't have more, otherwise it's going to be like a tower. I have a feeling that is, again, like, not in practice used, but that was a rule I heard.
That might be why the Colgate lasagna failed. Did you see this?
What?
In the 1980s, Colgate made a TV dinner beef lasagna, and it didn't sell. I think
why
probably...
did Colgate make it?
Well, I just... branching out, I guess. I don't think it sold very well because of the massive Colgate logo on the packet, which presumably made people think, is this going to taste minty? Is this like a mint lasagna? But it was pure, like, you know, American style lasagna. And yeah, it's in the Museum of Failures now in Sweden.
Oh, fun. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go visit.
On pasta shapes, did you see cascatelli invented in 2019 by a food podcaster?
Oh yeah, I think I have. What's it again? Remind me.
Well, it means, I mean, it's not very correct grammar, but apparently it means little waterfalls. But they, if you can imagine like a scoop with ruffles on the side. It was designed by this food podcaster nerd engineer guy who basically wanted the ultimate pasta shape.
I've got the shape up.
Oh yeah. It looks like that dinosaur in Jurassic Park that has the like crazy
Dilophosaurus.
Sprays the man in the eyes. Yeah, that one.
So he designed it to have maximum sauce retention and forkability, i.e., you know, ability to
forkability,
stab with
something
a fork.
I pride myself on. Let's move on to our second lunchbox, and that's you, Jack.
So I've brought in a pasta dish which is, it was close to extinction about 5 years ago, and it's called su filindeu.
Yes.
Is this the one that only like 3 women can make?
Yeah. But it's coming back. It's having a resurgence.
Because of Instagram, really.
Yeah, I think so. I think Instagram has saved the pasta dish. Anyway, a bit of history. So it means God's wool in Sardo, which is the language in one of the languages in Sardinia, which is actually apparently the closest living language to ancient Latin.
Ooh.
It's a very thin string. So it's like angel hair, if you can picture angel hair pasta. So you take a lump of dough and you pull it out, and then you fold it back over so that it becomes 2 strings. And then you do the same again, it becomes 4. You do the same again, it becomes 8, and so on. And when you have 256, each string is so thin that you then lay it down gently so they're all parallel across a circular basket lid made of asphodel, which...
What is asphodel?
Asphodel is a plant that you make, when you dry the stems, you can make wicker baskets out of. But it imparts a slight flavour. Anyway, once you've made enough of these strings and you've laid them all out across, like, imagine a mat, you do 3 layers of that and then you let it dry in the sun and then you can take it off the basket and it's like a pure disc of...
It looks like a spider's web kind of
it
like
does,
pasta.
Yeah, but like but a even, really dense
even
web.
Dense, yeah, for sure.
And then you break it up into small pieces and cook it in mutton broth and add some pecorino. And it's very traditional... dish in Sardinia. It would traditionally only serve to those who'd made the pilgrimage from Nuoro to Lula, which are 2 little towns and villages on the east coast of Sardinia, to celebrate the feast of Saint Francis. And basically it's not a secret recipe, it's just so hard to get the dough the right amount of elasticity. So I watched some clips of people doing it, and they're constantly like kneading the dough and then dipping their fingers in to get a tiny bit of water and then dipping their fingers in another bowl which has very salty water, and they're just getting it to the right elasticity mm-hmm. and bounce, and only they know when it's ready, and there's no way to teach it really other than to practice. And in fact, Jamie Oliver went and tried it in 2016 and he failed, and he said, I've cooked pasta for 20 years and this is the hardest thing. I can't do it.
I follow a man on Instagram, an amazing artisanal pasta maker from Singapore. His Instagram handle is BenFatto95. And he has gone to Sardinia and tried su filandero and like done a bit of a pilgrimage and even tried to learn it himself. He says that he spoke to a Sardinian and they said that the filandero are threads of God connected to the land, and that by extension the pasture and the pecorino, so that's the mutton broth and the cheese, form an unbreakable bond between the sheep's broth, the cheese, and the pasta, the su filandero.
So it's symbolic.
It's basically like really inherently Sardinian, because the sheep farming and sheep products are very, very much the Sardinian trade food.
Yeah, I gather.
It's an incredibly artisanal thing.
And labor intensive.
I was going to say, has anyone tried it here or no?
No, I've never had it.
I've been to Sardinia, but I didn't get to near, because I think it's only made in one town in Sardinia.
Yeah, it is. It's very labor intensive and very beautiful. I saw a guy hold it up to the sun and you can see it's like a patchwork of golden filaments.
Have you guys watched many of the Pasta Granny's videos on YouTube?
Yes, that's where I found them out.
I think that's, you know, one of my favorite things about pasta is that like it is so inherently like comforting as a food.
Yeah.
And that, you know, in Italy tradition, the best old pastas were made by these nonnas who are dying out. That generation is literally dying out, and they're still amazing cooks. They're still incredibly agile. They're rolling this pasta, and it's not easy to roll pasta by hand by any stretch.
They've all got massive forearms.
But they're just doing it, and they're like folding these tiny, 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 tiny tortellini like the size of a thumbnail. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, you're an amazing person. How did you do that?
Mm-hmm. But it's also, I watch those videos and they are an amazing archive of these things, but they're also tinged with a little bit of sadness, because I'm like, these poor women have spent like 50 years folding pasta to feed their family. Like, it's like, you know, with a bit of feminism, they might have been, you know, nuclear physicists.
I love how you need to choose between feminism and pasta.
Well, you don't have, I think
like,
what,
you can't
the
have one.
Is,
me and Manu are living embodiment that you do not.
You can have one, but you can't spend 40 years honing a craft without, you know, losing a bit of time.
Well, also, I think the idea that they had no other option, like they were, poverty was extreme and options for women certainly were very limited. So getting good at making pasta and making something from nothing, you know, flour and water, was what you had to do.
Yeah. So it's easy to hear that they've been doing this for 60 years, but not really imagine what that means in terms of social context.
Yeah. There's actually been some discourse in the food world recently around, like, when you make fresh pasta, you can roll it by hand. So in Bologna and in the north of Italy, you would find women called sfoglina, who are women who roll pasta by hand. And the sfoglia is the leaf of fresh pasta, the big flat disc. And does that make better pasta than pasta machine, this is the one you might have in your home, a sort of laminator. You put dough through, it gradually gets it thinner and thinner and thinner when you turn the crank. So there has become sort of a bit of snobbiness around using a machine, because they're like, oh no, but the really good stuff, the old stuff, was made by hand, and you can't call it handmade pasta unless you literally hand rolled it. And that's probably fair, but also, like, out of necessity, these machines were built, and they make it, you know, a much more approachable activity. You can create much more with that little machine than you can by yourself. There's some interesting, like, points of view from Italian chefs being like, don't say you're better than anyone just because you've made a sfoglia. That doesn't mean you're better. You're not a sfoglina. It doesn't make you a sfoglina. It just makes you someone who can make a sfoglia. Mm. Anyway, I was like, thank God, because I use my machine. I am getting close to being full, but I'm never really full because I can always eat. Good news is it's time for our final lunchbox, and that's you, Manu.
This is perfect because you've spoken so much about how to cook pasta properly. And in my lunchbox, I have some macaroni that has been cooked for 1¾ hours.
Wow. Interesting. Wow.
Have we heard of a woman called Mrs. Beaton?
Ah, yes, we know her.
Yeah, so a famous Victorian cookbook writer. Her book, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, which was published in 1861, is like an invaluable source for social historians and food historians of this period in Britain. Anyway, so she has 10 bajillion recipes in this book. It's a tome, but she's got one for macaroni cheese, and she tells you to cook the pasta for that long.
Was pasta different back then? I'm just picturing like a block of solid pasta that needs that amount of time.
I mean,
that
has got to be like literal mush. Yeah. There's no way that was holding a shape.
It's definitely mush, but it's really confusing because throughout the book, she talks about cooking pasta and she doesn't give a specific time. She just says, cook it until it's tender. With like a little bit of bite, which sounds great. But for some reason in this one, she talks about cooking the pasta and then like putting everything together, putting it under the fire to like get nice and crispy. But yeah, the time, 1½ hours to 1¾ hours to boil the macaroni, then 5 minutes to brown everything once it's mixed together.
Wow.
Oh my God.
It sounds very bad.
Yeah.
I've got to say, there's a lot of Beaton's food that I would rather not eat.
No, it was a different time, wasn't it?
Well, also, this is a thing. So there's a historian called Catherine Hughes who got obsessed with Mrs. Beaton and spent loads of time going through her work. And her biggest takeaway is that Mrs. Beaton cannot cook.
Right.
She is a terrible, terrible cook.
She's one of those people who's like much better publicist and writer.
Yeah.
Well, what's really interesting is her husband was in publishing. And it's actually a bit sad. So their child died and he was like, you know what, maybe just start doing something completely different. Start writing about food. So when she was about 21, she started writing recipes. And it was pretty obvious that she wasn't good. In her first recipe for Victoria Sponge, she completely forgot to talk about eggs. There are no eggs in it. And so Hughes goes through and tracks all of the actual original recipes and realizes that Mrs. Beaton's just plagiarized all of these, some word for word. She can't cook, isn't very good at copying either because she misses out ingredients. But one really cool thing that Mrs. Beaton has done, according to Hughes, is introduce the idea of putting ingredients lists at the start of recipes. So she has some contribution.
Right.
Which previously wasn't the norm.
Like, yeah.
So you just read through and then see, oh, turnips. We haven't bought any turnips.
Yeah.
I'm halfway through this, you know, pie.
She also introduces the idea of talking about how long to cook something for, whether that's right or not is up for debate. But yeah, so she's really important in kind of changing how we write recipes and like the world of cookery books. But she was so successful when she died, also quite young, at 28. Her family.
What? Yeah. She died at 28. She only wrote one big book, right?
She actually wrote quite a few books. So she started when she was 21. The one that we think about, the massive tome, Household Management, that's her most famous one. But she wrote for columns and stuff. So she died when she was 28. But her family hid the fact that she died so they could publish under
no
her
way.
Name.
Ghostwriting.
Yeah, man, it's so messed up.
The literal ghostwriting. So, wow, so often licked, never beaten.
What's up?
I don't even
say?
Understand that
it's
one.
Like, just want everyone to know that we're all just shaking our heads every time Jack speaks today.
At least I'm trying.
So I've also got another way not to cook pasta. So one, don't listen to Mrs. Beaton. Two, stop throwing your pasta at the wall. I was genuinely taught this by my mum. Has anyone else heard this?
Yeah, throwing it at the ceiling.
Yeah, or just any kind of surface. And if it sticks...
I threw it at my sister.
So yeah, if it sticks, it's done. Which obviously doesn't work because as long as it's got a bit of a tacky surface on the outside, which can be well overdone pasta or underdone pasta, it's going to stick. And people tried to trace back the origins of this like tip. Apparently it was published in a book called You Can Cook If You Can Read from the 40s.
Wow, so rude.
And everyone who couldn't read that title would be like, oh, it's just lost on them.
So yeah, that's how not to cook pasta.
Wow.
But yeah, whilst we're talking a little bit about pasta and history, Have you guys heard about Mussolini? Well, first, have you heard about Mussolini?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Benito.
See, great fascist dictator in Italy.
Great, really great
guy. Great guy. Loved him. So he tried to ban pasta during his dictatorship. So between the 20s and 30s. He decided that pasta was really bad for everyone.
Yeah, I was reading about this actually.
It's so weird. It was actually to do with reducing flour imports, initially, because they couldn't grow the wheat there. So he decided, oh, we should probably start eating things like rice and more citruses. He was like, you know what, pasta, not great. Let's start eating rice. Obviously, the Italians were not very happy about this. And then pasta eating became like a symbol of anti-fascism. Yeah, it's so cool. But the dude you're talking about, the poet, Filippo Tommaso Emilio Marinetti, also wrote a book called The Futurist Cookbook. And if you have time to flick through it, it's the absolute most bonkers thing. So it's got, yeah, lots of these alternative recipes. And I've got a little quote from him on pasta, but he says, pasta squitta?
Pasta shooter.
Pasta, what does that mean?
So pasta shooter refers specifically to pasta that has been cooked kind of the way we all enjoy it normally. Pasta that's been boiled and then tossed through a sauce, a condiment. It is opposed to pasta in brodo, which means a pasta in a broth. So technically pasta shooter literally means dry pasta, but it actually doesn't mean dried figuratively. It means dry as in not in broth.
Relatively dry. Wet, but not sopping wet.
Yeah, all right, Jack, that's disgusting.
And then there's pasta al forno, which is in the oven.
Okay.
That's how I understand that.
Yeah.
So pasta shooter, he says, however agreeable to the palate, is the passeist food because it makes people heavy, brutish, deludes them into thinking it is nutritious, makes them skeptical, slow, and pessimistic.
Wow.
Wow.
Oh, I know the futurists. Are they the ones who invented that dish that was like chicken with ball bearings?
Yeah, so you're
thinking of chicken with metal steel ball bearings.
It's called Hunting in Heaven. So you cook a hare slowly in sparkling wine and cocoa powder. Sounds great. And lots of lemon juice. You serve it with loads of sauce and spinach, and then you cover it in loads of ball bearings. You know, the little silver edible ones you put in cake to make it look like the huntsman's shop. So that's just one of his dishes.
They were also about like the other senses, the peripheral senses. So they would like have specific dishes with specific music or like the sounds of machines and like watching footage of factories and stuff. Because they were very much like the future.
Very Heston.
It was the 1920s. Mm. Yeah, kind of. I suppose it was experimental.
Yeah.
But they, were they pro-pasta or anti-pasta?
Oh, no, he...
Pro-fascist.
So that was the anti-pasta. Poet. He was one of the futurists.
Yeah, very fascist.
Actually, it's anti-pasty, babe. That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on at Lunchbox Envy Pod. Or you can email lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, before we go, do you have like your favourite pasta recipe recommendation?
Well, apart from the one that I already brought you in today, and also linguine alle vongole, if you haven't tried bucatini alla zozzona, then you should.
Ooh.
Because zozzo means filthy in Italian.
Ooh.
And zozzona is basically a hybrid of the four classic Roman pastas. So it's a egg and tomato sauce with guanciale, with pecorino, and with a bit of sausage.
Oh my God.
All tossed together. And the egg weirdly works so well with the tomato. It makes this like really creamy, luscious sauce. And it's delicious. And that recipe is available amongst other ones in my cookbook, Good Time Cooking.
Glad it's not just one recipe in your book.
Yeah, luckily. We will leave you with this from the American essayist Christopher Morley. No man is lonely eating spaghetti. It requires so much attention. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
See ya.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Orio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Liying Lee, and it was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Big news! Wayfair's end of season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end of season savings, and it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Big news! Wayfair's end of season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end of season savings, and it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.